Wayne asked me to talk about anything I wanted to, just don't be boring. I said, well, I'm a lawyer. It's kind of difficult. You need me to go to a different place in my mind. So I want to talk about some things that are very timely. One of them is the case of Perry versus Schwarzenegger. Now, you may not recognize that case, but this is the litigation over the Prop 8 litigation, or the Prop 8 statewide referendum that amended the California Constitution to create marriage between one man and one woman in the Constitution. Let me back up. That's been litigated in the courts here for about the last 2 months, but let me back up and give you a chronology and kind of give you an inside baseball view of what's going on and what that's all about. In 2000, the California voters went to the polls and amended their state statute. That's their state law, not constitution, their state statutes, and by a vote of 61% to 39%, incorporated marriage between one man and one woman in state law via their statutes. Which, that was good. Yeah. That was 2000, the beginning of the fight, the beginning of the troubles. In 2003, you may remember that the Massachusetts Supreme Court, actually it's called the Supreme Judicial Council, created same-sex marriage in America. First state ever to do this. This was the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Council. By the way, they did this. There was no authority for them to do this. So they had to import a foreign precedent from Canada. Imported a case from the Canadian Court of Appeals of Ontario, Canada, as the only legal authority to support what they did, which was to strike down 200 years of Massachusetts law and out of thin air create same-sex marriage. The legislature didn't do it. The court did it. So that was 2003. Now, we're getting more recent. You may remember in February of 2004, you may not remember the month, but I know you remember what happened in San Francisco. The mayor of San Francisco began issuing same-sex marriage licenses in violation of state law. Remember, there were hundreds, even a couple thousand people lined up in San Francisco trying to get these and getting these same-sex marriage licenses. Alliance Defense Fund, representing the group who was responsible for getting the state law changed in 2000, went to court in San Francisco and filed a litigation for an injunction. My wife, Linda, says, don't get too technical, Ben. So we went to court to stop it, right? Okay. Oddly, the judge we had in San Francisco in the Superior Court was a guy named Earl Warren III. He was the grandson of the infamous Earl Warren of the Warren Court. Now, we felt like we were sledding uphill to begin with, since we went to court and everybody in the courtroom. If I could take a picture of you all and reverse it 360 degrees or 180 degrees with pink colors, pink hair, orange hair, women with spiked hair. Just that's exactly what it was. In fact, after the first day, the bailiff in the courtroom asked us not to go out into the street by ourselves to get a taxi. He wanted to walk us out there for our safety. And so it was really a zoo. In any event, second day of the hearing before Judge Warren, there was an article published in the San Jose Mercury. Judge Warren is, shall we say, at ADF. He engages in homosexual behavior, lives with his boyfriend. This is our trial judge asking him to overturn the issuance of same-sex marriage licenses, which were bogus in San Francisco. Well, we knew we were dead meat, and he proved it that afternoon. He ruled against us. He said, I know this is against the law, but sometimes you have to do what's really the right thing in your own eyes. Didn't Scripture talk about that somewhere in Romans? So we lost. But we took a direct appeal up to the California Supreme Court, actually filed this up. Well, it's irrelevant what the name of it was, but we went to the California Supreme Court, and in August of 2004, got an order from that court holding that what San Francisco did was illegal in California, and overturned all of those bogus same-sex marriage licenses. That was great. It was a major victory. Jordan Lawrence of our office argued it. It was on California TV. It was on C-SPAN nationally, and it was just a great time of celebration. So everything that San Francisco did, we were able to overturn. But a separate lawsuit was filed shortly after that, challenging the state referendum that had incorporated marriage between a man and a woman. There was the lawsuit was filed saying that that was unconstitutional under the California Constitution. Okay, so this was round two. And in May of 2008, we were involved in that case representing, again, the group that passed the referendum in 2000. In May of 2008, the California Supreme Court struck down the 2000 referendum. They held that the referendum, which declared that marriage was between one man and one woman in California, was unconstitutional under the California Constitution, right? And so they threw it out. And so for a period of months, California began issuing same-sex marriage licenses. The good news is that we began working with a group called the Prop 8 Committee. The Prop 8 Committee put the issue on the ballot. What do California voters want? Do they want marriage between a man and a woman, or do they want marriage to be between persons of the same sex? And this was a real lively, hotly debated, hotly contested referendum in California. We saw Christians who had vote yes for Prop 8 have their cars vandalized by the hundreds. Churches who publicly supported Prop 8 and marriage between a man and a woman were invaded, literally. We have videos of that. I didn't bring it. Where people would run up and down the aisles during church service, throwing out this literature and disrupting the services, that people would come out to their cars and have the windows smashed, that people who supported Prop 8 were fired from their jobs, businesses who gave money in support of Prop 8 were boycotted and, leases terminated and this kind of thing. The problem was in California that there's a law on the books that says that if you give $100 or more in support of a statewide referendum to amend the Constitution, that your identity, your home address, and the identity and address of your employer must be given to the state, right? The state then published all of that information online. And so the homosexual radicals can find out who is supporting, who is behind Prop 8. And so they attacked them, ridiculed them, this kind of stuff. This was 2.5 minutes. We could have put together a 30-minute montage of the tapes we have. It was really quite shocking, I mean, to say the least. Now, the good news is we've gone into federal court to try to have that law overturned, and that's still working in the courts. Now, let's get back to Prop 8. So we know that in the summer and the fall of 2008, the campaign was on to amend the Constitution of California to enshrine marriage as between a man and a woman in the Constitution. In November, we prevailed. Prop 8 passed by a vote of almost 52% to 48. Now, that was wonderful news. The bad news was that the next day, Prop 8 was challenged in the California courts again by homosexual activists. Now, we litigated that case representing the Prop 8 Committee back to the California Supreme Court, and in May of 2009, the California Supreme Court shockingly upholds Prop 8. They say it's a valid statewide referendum that amended the Constitution. It's perfectly valid under the California Constitution. Okay. The other side had argued that the amendment to the Constitution was unconstitutional. In other words, it was a crazy argument, but thank goodness that we won. 3 days before the judge's decision, the court's decision, there were seven judges in that case, in May of 2009, 3 days before the decision, two lawyers from the D.C. and Boston area, one Ted Olson and one David Boyce, you may remember David Boyce, he represented Al Gore in the Florida recount fight, filed suit in federal court in San Francisco alleging that the statewide referendum was unconstitutional under the federal constitution. Remember, the California court had said it passed muster under the state constitution. Well, they were doubling up on like if it were a poker game, they were doubling up. They were saying it's unconstitutional under the federal constitution. Now, it's odd that, now this is sort of inside baseball stuff. Ted Boyce and David Boyce and Ted Olson are not in the vanguard of what at ADF we call the homosexual legal movement. And it really is a legal movement. It's a political, socio, and a legal movement. These guys are basically, well, Ted Boyce is an activist Republican, but Olson was one of the founders of the Federalist Society, which is a Republican-oriented organization. And why he's involved in the lawsuit, I just do not know. But the same-sex marriage organizations really opposed this lawsuit because they were not, taking the lead in the lawsuit. Now, since then, they've kind of come in and are now supporting it. But, you know, it was interesting seeing the back and forth on the blogs in that case. So this is the Prop 8 case that I'm here to talk about. That was called Perry versus Schwarzenegger. The Attorney General of California is a guy named Jerry Brown. Many of you know him. The Attorney General of California is mandated by law to defend state constitutional referenda. He refused to do it. So Jerry Brown said, you passed it, it's been challenged in court, and I'm not going to do a thing, I'm not going to lift a finger to defend it. Okay, so he was out of the picture. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is supposed to be a Republican, is a Republican, decided that he wasn't going to defend it either. So the two highest public officials in California refused to defend the traditional marriage amendment to the Constitution. Now, fortunately, the federal judge allowed the Prop 8 committee, whom we represented, to intervene in the lawsuit to defend the proposition. Now, that was the irony there is that all the state public officials are not defending it, but private citizens in California are. Now, we have been litigating that thing for almost a year now, or 7 or 8 months. We have close to 10 lawyers working on it around the clock. We brought in a lawyer from Washington, D.C. named Chuck Cooper, who's sort of the opposite number. He's a very well-regarded guy in judicial circles, to be our lead counsel in the case. It's been litigated, it's been tried, and it's the evidence is over. We're waiting for the judge's decision, which will come in about 2 weeks. Now, who's paying Ted Olson and David Boyce, the lawyers representing this legal challenge? Maria Shriver, the governor's wife, Sean Penn, this crowd in Hollywood, Norman Lear, anybody? So there are millions of dollars coming out of Hollywood to support this lawsuit. Now, bear in mind, Maria Shriver is the wife of the governor, the very official who's mandated by law to defend the referendum, which is turns reality on its head. And so what's at stake here? If we lose in the trial court, which we may, and I'll explain why in a minute, same-sex marriage will be the law of the land in the Northern District of California, which is the San Francisco Bay Area, a little bit south, a little bit north. There'll be an appeal to the Ninth Circuit. Some of you may know that the Ninth Circuit is the most liberal circuit in the nation. Not a good circuit for us to litigate this issue, but we feel like we'd be pretty strong there. But what we really are banking on, frankly, is that we have 5 votes of the Supreme Court if we can keep Justice Kennedy, because this case is going to go to the Supreme Court. Now, if we lose in the federal district, I mentioned it's going to create same-sex marriage, oddly, in only one section of California. If we lose the Ninth Circuit, they have jurisdiction of every state from Arizona to Alaska to Hawaii, including Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and so forth, Nevada. The Ninth Circuit will create same-sex marriage in all of those states, despite the state constitutional amendment, which we passed here a couple of years ago. I think Kathy Herod's been here talking about that. So this case is enormously, enormously significant and important. Our judge, again, this is sort of inside baseball stuff. Our judge is a guy named Walker. He was appointed by Bush Sr. What can I say about him? He's not friendly to Christians. He's not friendly to any religious people. And he wanted this case to be televised. Now, there's a rule in the federal courts that no federal trials or hearings will be televised. But he went ahead and ordered, he violated his own, the court's own rules and ordered that the trial be on television. In fact, he ordered it to be on television on YouTube. Okay? Now we're thinking, why in the world is he doing this? Because we know when a high-profile case goes on television, it becomes the O.J. Simpson trial. Right? The lawyers become, they become actors in this real reality TV series. And they want to write books and get famous. And we knew the whole thing was going to be just crazy if that happened. So we went to the Ninth Circuit and asked the court to stop the televising of this of the trial, and they refused. In the meantime, our expert witnesses, who we had lined up, told us that they would not go on the witness stand because they were afraid for their safety, afraid for their homes, and afraid of getting fired from the universities where they were employed if the thing was on television, because they knew that they would have a big bullseye over their faces. And the people, the proponents of same-sex marriage, as you've seen, are crazy. Lawyers engage in hyperbole and all this. These people are totally irrational. They're people without a religion. This is their religion. And they hate Christians, and they hate Mormons, and they hate traditional Roman Catholics. And when I mean hate, I mean hate. And our witnesses were basically said, most of them said, we will not testify if it's on television. I don't want to get shot leaving the courtroom. I don't want my house getting burned down. We went to the U.S. Supreme Court 45 minutes before the beginning of the trial. The U.S. Supreme Court issued an order banning or stopping the televised trial. Took the cameras out of the courtroom. Thank goodness for that. And so the case went ahead without being on television. The problem was that we only had three witnesses left because the rest of them, again, had been afraid to go on, and they didn't know that it wasn't going to be on television until 40, 45 minutes before the trial began. Judge Walker, I know that there's some lawyers here. This is strictly a question of law. Does it violate the Equal Protection Clause? Does it violate the substantive due process provision of the Constitution? Or doesn't it? But he's allowing the plaintiffs in this lawsuit to introduce they basically paraded a couple of dozen people to the witness stand saying, I want to get married, and there's weeping, and I've lived with my live-in boyfriend or girlfriend for all these years, yada, yada. And to a lawyer, it's totally irrelevant what a personal opinion is. It was totally emotion-based. We always wondered, why in the world did he want to televise this? Because we knew that this would just stir up the mob. Remember, this is in San Francisco, downtown San Francisco, not a friendly place for our side. And so we let just about anything in. We put on some expert testimony saying that, there hadn't been same-sex marriage in any civilization, any culture in history. The other side countered by saying, no, there was one in Africa where warriors of a tribe would constrict young boys and take them, off to the battlefield with them, and they became sex slaves for the duration of the war, and that was marriage. That was a form of marriage, they said. And then when they came back, they went back to their wives. That was their argument. That was the only example of same-sex marriage, being a part of any culture in the entire history of the world. 3 days after the end of the evidence, this was just 2 weeks ago, the San Francisco Chronicle published an article that reported that Judge Walker is homosexual, divorced and kids living with his boyfriend. You're going to think that this is something like crazy. You couldn't write a novel like this. But it all started fitting into place. And he is, as the world would call, gay. Now, does that mean he's automatically going to rule against us? Not necessarily. But I submit, and the lawyers in my office think, that it would be virtually impossible for him to live in San Francisco, to be a judge in that federal court, to be homosexual, and vote in favor of marriage between one man and one woman, and deny same-sex marriage to all the people there who want it. It's going to be very difficult. So We have a pretty good record, we think. We put on our evidence with our experts, and our cross-examination was very good. There's a real good chance we're going to lose in the trial court, and we'll have that decision here in about 2 or 3 weeks, we think. If we lose, we'll go to the Ninth Circuit and fight there. And if we lose there, we feel very good about going to the Supreme Court. These people, you know, all they have to do is win once. We have to win every time. And ADF, the Lord has blessed us, really. It's totally, all the credit goes to Him to allow us to be involved in almost every one of these battles across the nation. ADF litigation didn't exist in any meaningful way when the first Massachusetts case was decided in 2003. Now, I know some of you are looking at me like you're saying, oh, we're going to lose. Take heart. The Lord of the universe can do anything He wants. We may win this case. And in the end, this is a three-round battle. And every time the case goes to another level, it gets more significant. And we feel really, really good about the present makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court. We don't believe that there's any chance that the court will allow the Ninth Circuit to create same-sex marriage for all of the Western states. They will grant review and they will reverse. So long as we can hang on to our five. So pray that the conservatives stay healthy. This is going to go on for a few years. The tough question is, what happens if the judge rules against us and refuses to issue a stay to his ruling? In other words, allowing same-sex marriage to exist for maybe the year or two between the trial court and going to the Supreme Court. That'll be a real fight. Now, we can accelerate that by filing an emergency appeals and so forth and deal with that in that way. But there's a lot of lawyering to do. And, you know, ADF is, come by and see us sometime. You know, I'm going to shift here for a minute. And I feel I'm depressing myself about what's going on. But, you know, the lawyers in the office, they've worked so hard in this thing. And they're really quite heroic in that way. Now, what else is at stake? Let me just mention that this whole case has been associated with vicious attacks on Christianity. Vicious, and I mean vicious. Every witness on the plaintiff's side testified that, and they had some expert testifying on the plaintiff's side, testified that if you were a Christian or a Mormon and you had religious motives for voting in favor of traditional marriage, then that was an illegal motive, that was illicit, that your vote was tainted by bias and prejudice. And the judge, Judge Walker, just sat there and nodded his head the whole time. And so this was the feel and the ambience of the trial. And honestly, I've never quite experienced anything like it. In San Francisco. I love the city. Linda and I, who's sitting here, go there and love the restaurants and for long weekends and stuff, and beautiful city, but the politics and the mob that's taken over that city is quite beyond my ability to communicate in dealing with those folks. You know, the second night of the hearing, I stayed with two other lawyers in a hotel downtown. We didn't know the hotel. We just got it online. It wasn't a very nice hotel. And we were checking in and noticed that there was what looked like a motorcycle gang in the lobby. And, okay, the motorcycle gang, that's, you know, we're going to be here just one night and we're going to get out of here. And so we came down to eat and we noticed that it was a gay motorcycle gang. I no kidding, I'm serious. I didn't know there were such things. And there were like about 40 or 50 of them in leather and the pants and the bikes and the whole thing, and I don't know what to say. Maybe I'm stuck in time, live in Scottsdale, where you don't really encounter this kind of thing too much, but this marriage battle is pretty huge.
Did you eat there?
We went next door. We didn't eat there. We didn't eat there. People ask me, well, Ben, what's the big deal? People just want to love each other, want to get married. Well, as believers, we know that, and from Wayne, I know you've heard a lot, that, you know, marriage is a sacrament. It's God's ordinance for ordering marriage according to His plan. But now, let's put that aside for a minute. What are the ramifications of same-sex marriage if it passes? It's a frontal assault on Christian rights of conscience in a variety of ways. We're representing several churches in California that during the period of time when same-sex marriage was on the books there, before we had it overturned, they refused to perform same-sex marriages in their sanctuary. They were sued under California law for engaging in discrimination. All right? We represent a Christian photographer in New Mexico who was asked to be a photographer at a lesbian commitment ceremony in New Mexico. This Christian couple said, "You know, I'm sorry, we can't do it. We're Christians. We can't participate in this. We don't support it." They were sued by the New Mexico Civil Human Rights Commission, lost at the commission hearing, and were ordered to pay $8,000 to the other side in attorney's fees. That case is now on appeal. In New Jersey, we represent a church that refused to allow its property to be used for lesbian domestic partnership ceremony. They were sued by the State Human Rights Commission and had proceedings initiated against them by the IRS of New Jersey seeking to invalidate their tax-exempt status retroactively to the founding of the church almost 50 years before. Which, if successful, that would have been, they would have liquidated the church, because who has that kind of money? Fortunately, we were able to stop both of those things, and the church is in good standing and has been able to withstand both of those frontal assaults. There's so many unforeseen consequences for believers if same-sex marriage is institutionalized. Anyway, let me move on to Wayne asked me to talk about another case called Martinez versus Hastings Law School. This is a case involving a Christian group at a law school, a Christian Legal Society group, that has been thrown off campus. Let's look at the second video. Our public universities have unconstitutional speech codes, which are used against Christian expression in a variety of ways. And that information, that data that our Center for Academic Freedom has won 100% of its cases is absolutely correct. I was chief counsel there for 8 years at ADF, and one of the things I was judged on was percentage of victory, so we kept real close track of that. I knew if we lost a bunch of cases every year, the university guys would always come through. And they're really good lawyers, and they're very wise in their litigation strategy, but the left has so overreached on university campuses. It's just amazing. The Hastings case is a huge case. It's at the U.S. Supreme Court. The case involves a Christian Legal Society group that had the audacity to require that its voting members and officers be Christians. Now think about that. Is that crazy? The university thought that was a form of discrimination. You see that Christian ministries on campus can't require that its officers be Christians. Under these rules, this is University of California Hastings Law School, again in the Bay Area. And so they threw them literally off campus, prohibited them from using meeting rooms, getting any funding, same kind of things that other clubs get. Fortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court has granted review on that case, and we'll be arguing that case in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I believe. We'll have that decision probably in the fall. It's a huge case. Now, what are the ramifications of that? The issue in that case is whether a Christian ministry can require that its members and officers be Christians. Okay, what's the very next step if that case is lost? Can a church or a paraministry like ADF or Center for Academic Policy, Center for Arizona Policy, which are Christian, they're chartered as Christian organizations, can we require that our members be Christians, and that the leadership, the elder board, be professing Christians? That's where they're going with all of this. And you think, oh, Ben, you're exaggerating. That can't be true. It is true. I do some work in Europe, and several months ago, I may have mentioned this when I was here before. If I did, I'm just going to hit it again. I was at something called the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, called the Helsinki Commission. And its mandate, it's a UN commission, its mandate is to protect human rights in Europe and North America. One of the groups that are there regularly is the International Humanist Society. Now, their deal is to break down all discrimination, that they call it, against non-Christians, them. And what they want to do is make it impossible for churches and Christian organizations to exclude them from full participation in the Christian organization or the Christian ministry or the Christian church. Now, what's their hook? Well, churches in Europe get national subsidies. In France, when you do your income tax return, you can check a box. Do you want your money to go to Catholic, Protestant, Jewish? Or you can presumably not check anything, but the government will decide where your money goes. But they get subsidies from the federal government, from the national governments. That allows the national governments to put their hooks in these churches. And it's entirely conceivable that they may order the churches not to exclude non-Christians from full membership and full participation in churches. Now, but Ben, that's crazy. That'll change churches as we know them. That'll change the whole role of church in society. Exactly. That is precisely what they want. The left cannot win, cannot go where they want to go, so long as the single biggest thing opposing them, and that's people who believe in transcendent objective values and God's standards, and that there is a God and he exercises judgment over us. So long as that's vibrant, the church is vibrant, they're going to have a lot of difficulty moving to where they want to go. And that's the name of the game in the Hastings case. If they can, this is just one step. You may have remembered a decade ago when they first introduced civil unions and domestic partnerships in the whole homosexual marriage battle, or people thought, well, it's only fair. Let's create civil unions, and that way these folks can have hospital visitation or insurance or, inherit death benefits, things of that nature. The problem is that once that was created, right, you established a separate but unequal relationship. In other words, the government was deciding that this relationship is worthy and valuable enough to protect by civil unions and civil partnerships. Therefore, how can we deny them the right to get married? Right? That's an argument we're hearing in court. And it's sort of like the slippery slope or the camel's nose in the tent, the law of unintended consequences. When you give little things away, it results in big things down the road. So watch the Hastings case. We're partnering with the Christian Legal Society in that lawsuit. We think that we're very strong in that case. We think we have the votes to win. Someone told me that the key to winning a case at the U.S. Supreme Court is not whether your case is weaker or strong, though. It's how many votes can you count? Because these people are flesh and blood, and we know they're very political. Right now, we've got 5, we think. The third thing I want to talk about, and I want to leave some time for some questions, is a case called A, B, and C versus Ireland, which is a huge case. It's called the Roe v. Wade of Europe. In 1983, Ireland amended its national constitution to enshrine marriage between one man and one woman as a part of their constitution. It's part of their fundamental law. It would be like in America, our First Amendment, or one of the Ten Amendments, first Ten Amendments was marriage between a man and a woman. That's what they did because they were worried about what they saw as trends in the rest of Europe. That has now been challenged at the European Court of Human Rights, which is like the Supreme Court of Europe. All of Europe has subordinated its national Supreme Courts to the super court, which sits in Strasbourg, France. 3 women who had to go to England to get abortions, they reside in Ireland, are challenging Ireland's constitutional ban on abortion. I'm sorry. I completely jumped. My head is still back in same-sex marriage. They enshrined a ban on abortion in their national constitution. in Ireland in 1983. Three women who wanted to have abortions couldn't, and so they had to go to England to have their abortions. They've challenged the ban on abortion at the Strasbourg European Court of Human Rights. Now, the good news is that the reason we lost Roe v. Wade, we believe, is because Christians didn't show up. Christian lawyers didn't show up. People who were armed and you know, with the law and able to deal with the issues and arguments were not there. We have been able to successfully intervene in the ABC versus Ireland case and were able to participate in that hearing about a month ago. The European Court of Human Rights should issue its decision in about a month, I would say. Now, the good news is, if they rule our way, then they will establish that, that a nation in Europe can ban abortion in its constitution. And there's nothing that the European Union or the Council of Europe or these international organizations can do about it. That's on the positive side. On the negative side, all 47 nations that make up modern Europe, from Russia to England to Spain to even Turkey, are subordinated to the European Court of Human Rights. And if they declare that there is an international right to abortion, any of these countries, most of them who have restrictive abortion laws, including three, Poland, Ireland, and Malta, which ban all abortions, will have their laws overturned. And there will be an international law, an international right to have abortion on demand in all of Europe. That'll make it very difficult for us down the road to overturn Roe v. Wade, because our court is very influenced by events in Europe. I hope I didn't depress you with all that. I'm just giving you a report from what we're doing out there. You know, we have our lawyers are terrific. You know, God has given us so many amazing victories that really can't be explained by in human terms. We have 1,600 allied lawyers across America and also in Europe and Latin America and Africa. We have 41 full-time lawyers working on these issues in 8 offices across the United States. We have the best, I believe, the best Christian lawyers in America working on these cases and standing up for our Christian rights. Questions? Any questions? Yes, sir. Well, how would you make that argument in terms of the First Amendment? What would the argument be?
They have the right to freedom of assembly, freedom of speech.
Yeah.
So why how should they be restricted?
Yeah. We argue that they have a First Amendment freedom of association and that the government is prohibited from engaging in what's called viewpoint-based discrimination, which is what they're doing. In other words, they're discriminating against people on the basis of their Christian beliefs and Christian views. You know what? That is, I think, the prevailing argument. And they're arguing, though, that there is an argument. They have an associational right not to be excluded from a group which receives benefits from the government. Okay? Anytime the government puts its hooks into you, all the rules change. Now, if you have just a private group, you can pretty much do what you want. But if you get any benefit from the government, in this case, simply having a meeting room on campus, simply getting maybe a couple hundred dollars for your flyers.
So
sir?
Are they going to try to attack the church with the tax code, basically?
Well, yes. I mean, that's another battle that's going on. You know, we have something called the Church Project, which I talked about, I think, last time I was here, in which I talked about the Johnson Amendment. It was passed in 1954 that, for the first time, conditioned tax-exempt status enjoyed by churches and had been enjoyed by churches since colonial days was conditioned upon pastors not speaking out on political topics during election season. For the first time, a pastor couldn't communicate scripture, apply scripture to the political issues of the day. And that's another form of the battle we're fighting in the Hastings lawsuit. So it goes beyond the Christian Legal Society. Groups on campus like Campus Crusade for Christ, Athletes in Action, you name it, if the Supreme Court goes the wrong way, they'll be required to admit non-Christians as members. Now, Christian Legal Society, just to take this one step further, will allow anybody to come to its meetings. In fact, the very purpose of the organization, in part, is to evangelize, to share the gospel. So they welcome non-believers to their meetings. To be a voting member, just like to be a member of this church, you have to sign on to a certain statement of faith and demonstrate that you're a believer. And that's what they do. But the university would say that, well, that's exclusionary, that's discriminatory. Of course, the problem is if you have a bunch of Muslims or atheists come and become voting members, they can vote their own people in. And the Christian organization stops being a Christian organization, starts being something else. So it's a real collision in worldviews. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about the discrimination against Christians. It seems to me that Muslims and Orthodox Jews also hold the same views that we have on abortion and marriage. Is there an attack on Muslims and on Orthodox Jews by the homosexuals and for the anti-Christian movement in the same way that they're attacking us, or are the Muslims and the Orthodox Jews not speaking out?
Yeah. Oddly, there haven't been frontal assaults on those groups. And I guess a sociologist could tell us why. But, I mean, the Mormons and Christians, both traditional Catholic and evangelical Protestants, are in the lead for you know, saving marriage. The Muslims, to a large extent, I mean, in terms of large numbers, you really don't see a huge communities of Muslims except for Dearborn, Michigan, outside of Detroit. And I don't know what's happened up there, frankly, but certainly Orthodox Jews support us big time. And they may well have been attacked, I just don't know. But the Mormons, we couldn't have passed Prop 8 in California were it not for the Mormons. I want to give them a lot of credit. They stepped up with huge dollars. And without that partnership, we couldn't have done this thing.
Back to this Judge Walker. Couldn't he recuse himself? Or couldn't you demand that he recuse himself?
Well, he could recuse himself if he chose to, but he's not going to choose to. Plus, it's too late. And no, a judge's sexuality or sexual orientation or sexual behavior is not legal grounds for getting a judge recused. It is not. If the judge has financial interest in the outcome of the case, yes.
Well, he would have financial interest if it does go his way.
But I think that that argument would be too attenuated. It would be not concrete enough.
And then the other thing is this discrimination against the Christians. Couldn't they sue for hate crime?
Yeah, you know, hate crimes and hate speech are laws that we really oppose. And the laws in California really, we'd hate to use something that we're challenging in court as unconstitutional. Because frankly, hate speech is actually the last thing on my list I was going to talk to if I had time. Hate speech laws and hate crimes laws are being used against Christians worldwide, especially in Europe and Canada, to censor us. Like Pastor Rocky Green, the Swedish pastor, was charged with a hate crime for preaching a sermon from Romans chapter 1 verses 25 to 28 that, you know, God considers homosexual behavior a sin. That got him sentenced to 30 days in jail. And that was finally overturned by the Swedish Supreme Court. So we don't support those laws. We think they violate our Constitution and are trying to knock them down wherever we can. Hate speech laws have been used against Christians trying to evangelize Muslims. How can you share the gospel with a Muslim without implicitly at least criticizing or critiquing the Muslim faith? I don't know how you do it. And that is considered hate speech in many parts of Europe today, in Australia as well. So I went way past your question, but no, that's problematic for us.
What's the difference between the Christian Legal Society and your organization?
What's the question between the Christian Legal Society, Christian Legal Society, and Alliance Defense Fund? Well, first, they're a partner and an ally with us. But Christian Legal Society, it was founded in, I think, 1962. It's primarily a ministry for Christian lawyers and law students to each other, to minister to each other. It's more fellowship and worship together, where they can support each other, hold each other up in prayer and discipleship, things of that nature. It's generally, it's not an organization that engages in activism. Right? ADF is trying to defend and reclaim ground we've lost for believers. Christian Legal Society would be a place believers would go have lunch together, pray together, maybe worship together, and have fellowship. I'm a member of the Christian Legal Society, and again, we partner with them. They're our clients in this case. Right? In fact, they actually had five lawyers on staff that formed a fairly small litigation group that was doing much of the same work we were doing, and then they ran into some difficulties on the funding side, and we hired all five of them in our Washington, D.C. office. So I think all the lawyers at ADF were all Christian Legal Society members. Hope that's not too complicated.
Just a question. If you, on the case over in California on the Prop 8, so let's say you lose at the district, the circuit court, and have to go to the Supreme Court, and let's say they rule in your favor, does that then establish a new law of the land, if you will, kind of like Roe v. Wade did, and therefore the Massachusetts, and is it maybe Iowa that have same-sex marriage laws, would those essentially be nullified?
No. It would establish as a law of the land that marriage between, as defined as between one man and one woman, does not violate the federal constitution. That would still give states the right, if they chose to create same-sex marriage. Right? You know, one of the ironies is that we had the votes to create to put same-sex marriage on the ballot in Massachusetts. To overturn the Supreme Court's decision there. But the state legislature blocked it and wouldn't allow it to go on the ballot. But everywhere these state amendments have been on the ballots, we've won eventually. In Arizona, we had to do it twice. Second time, we won. Does that make sense to you? That Roe v. Wade basically held that an abortion is a constitutional right up to a certain point. In the pregnancy. If we lost in the Supreme Court, it would be the Roe v. Wade of same-sex marriage. It would say that same-sex marriage is a right that persons have under the federal constitution. On the other hand, if we won there, it would be that no, it's not a right. Right? But it'd be the same thing if we had won Roe v. Wade and the court had held that abortion is not a right guaranteed by the federal constitution. Okay? The states could still pass their own baby Roe v. Wade on the state level.
This is one of those small points, perhaps, but is there a legal reason why we are referring to homosexual unions or relationships where they are as same sex now? I feel like our perspectives change because our vocabulary is getting hijacked. I don't believe in gay. They're homosexual. Same sex marriages are homosexual together, whatever. But I hear same sex. It seems so accepting.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think if we lose the lexicon, if we lose the language, we lose the war. That's what Orwell said in 1984. We have a lexicon, an official lexicon at ADF. There are certain words we do not use. We do not use the word gay. I did a little while ago. I tried to put it in quotes. We do not use the word homosexual. We say people engage in homosexual behavior. We believe people have a choice. We believe that the Lord wouldn't have made it a sin if we didn't have a choice. That doesn't mean that people don't have an equal burden. Some have a heavier burden to carry, just like alcoholism runs in families. But if you adopt the word, if you start using the word sexual orientation or gay or homosexual, then you're implicitly saying you may have been born that way and you can't change. We know the power of God can change anything and do anything. We agree with what you just said. We just focus on it a little bit differently. Yeah. Other questions? Well, let me mention that we do have some literature on the table in the back, and I invite you to take some of that if you want to learn more about Alliance Defense Fund. And I do apologize about being so glum today. I don't mean to be, honestly. You know, I'm an old trial lawyer, and we're all always optimistic. And in this case, we're optimistic for good reason. We believe that we're going to win the marriage battle, we're going to win the Hastings case, and we're going to win the ABC case in the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. Remember that how long did the fight go on for slavery before it became illegal in America? 1865. And we had to fight a war. But there were, for 100 years, more than 100 years, there were abolitionist voices, both in the United States and in Europe and in America, speaking out against slavery and the evils of slavery. And science is on our side on the abortion question, for instance. The sonogram is our best friend. You know, we do surveys and read surveys all the time. Do you know that the overwhelming majority of college students today, Christian or non-Christian, are pro-life? They don't get it. They don't get it on the whole homosexual marriage issue. They don't understand why that's wrong. But they do get abortion. They understand that abortion is wrong. And these are not believers. These are people who've seen, you know, heard about sonograms, seen movies and stuff, which are tending to be more pro-life in many respects. And we have handouts in the back. Ron's holding one up if you want to get some of ADF material. And I think that I have permission to excuse us. So thank you. Thank you so much.